Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we learn some of the adventurous history of TSR, the Wisconsin company behind the influential role-playing game Dungeons & Dragons. Now, GOP Assembly Speaker Robin Voss fired former State Supreme Court Justice Michael Gableman last Friday, removing Gableman from his role as lead investigator on an election probe, searching for evidence of suspected election fraud back in 2020. Voss sent a letter to Gableman ending that probe just 1 week after Gableman and former President Trump publicly supported Voss's primary challenger. You can join our conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you think Voss is right to fire Gableman and put an end to the probe? Do you think that the year-plus effort was worth it, or was it, in your view, a waste of money? Do you want to know more about the 2020 elections, or is it time to turn the page? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Kathleen Dolan is Distinguished Professor of Political Science at UW-Milwaukee. Kathy, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you.
Big picture, what, if anything, do you see coming out of this year-plus probe?
Well, I think the biggest thing that comes out of this year-plus probe is keeping in the news the idea, without any evidence at all, that there might have been something wrong with the 2020 election here in Wisconsin or even nationally. We have had no evidence ever anywhere in the United States that there was anything compromised about the 2020 election, but we have spent 2 years talking about that. And as we know, when people hear things, they don't always hear all the details. And so there is reason for concern that people, some people in the United States and in Wisconsin, come away with a sense that our elections are not free and fair, which we know they are. But too long a focus on the issue could lead some people to believe that there are problems when they shouldn't.
I want to go back to the beginning here with a listen to Assembly Speaker Voss announcing the Gableman investigation. This is at the Republican State Convention last year in the summer.
We are going to make a major announcement right now. Many of you know that the legislature has hired retired investigators who are beginning the process of looking into the shenanigans that happened during the course of the past year. Okay? Correct. But what if I told you that we were going to hire somebody who was a former district attorney, former circuit court judge who has actually seen what's happened, former member of the Wisconsin Supreme Court, who is going to be the election coordinator with those three officers who are going to do it? What if I told you his name is Mike Gableman?
Now, just last week, Voss described Gableman as an embarrassment to Wisconsin. Can you talk about the politics of that, an announcement at the Republican State Convention of this appointment?
So, you know, let me just say before I answer, you, in playing that clip, gave more airtime to the concerns that I just raised. And one of the real dilemmas about these issues is the more time we spend talking about them, in some ways, the less able we are to refute them and to bring forward the truth. But the bookends of this probe, Speaker Voss announcing it at the Republican State Convention last year, it was very clear at the time, and we all know that in the intervening years since, that he did that at the behest of former President Trump. It was done for political reasons. It was done after Speaker Voss resisted doing exactly what he did for some period of time. And then when you fast forward to the end of the process, we know that the reason he did away with the investigation was political as well, because Gableman had turned on him in supporting Speaker Voss's primary challenger. Former President Trump had continued to be very critical and had also supported Adam Steen. And so Speaker Voss was retaliating from a political perspective. It is unlikely that Speaker Voss would say to us that he was committed to the investigation of the election because he dismissed it with a wave of a hand. So it was born in politics and it died in politics, and that is not to the betterment of the people of Wisconsin.
Talking to Kathleen Dolan from UW-Milwaukee, looking at the end of the Republican-appointed Gabelman probe of Wisconsin's 2020 elections. You could join in with your reactions, your thoughts on this whole process at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Nate is with us in Madison. Nate, hi.
Thank you. I couldn't agree with the speaker more. This is a pure political fiasco, and the sad thing is, this is direct taxpayer money being paid for a political adventure. Like the speaker said, it was initiated because of pressure from the former president, who now is in a ton of legal trouble, which says something about who he was. And it's continuing with a political closure because now it's become unpalatable to Speaker Voss, who is the one who initiated it. So the answer, folks, is throw these bums out. These Republicans who spend our money for political purposes. There you go.
Nate, thanks for the call. Kathy, Nate sees a waste of money as well as time here. Are there, do you think, consequences for people who have raised these questions about the 2020 elections, who've put this kind of money into it in Wisconsin or elsewhere?
Well, you know, unfortunately, as Nate suggests, you know, there are sort of broader problems here. You know, we could ask Speaker Voss if he has complete confidence in the primary election in which he just stood. He won that election, and so, of course, he's comfortable with the results. A significant problem here is people questioning elections when and only when they don't like the results. So as we watch around the country, we have seen sort of a mixed bag of results. We have seen election deniers win in some places. We have seen some election deniers lose. From the Republican Party's perspective, it may be unfortunate that more of them have won than not. But we are going through elections currently, and what we should be concerned about is how people approach the 2022 elections this fall.
Now, there have been kind of two different threads of criticism. As you mentioned, claims of voter fraud, it just wasn't there. I think many, many findings have found no fraud or very limited single-digit numbers. There's been some criticism about some decisions that were kind of ambiguous in law, like drop boxes, for example. State law didn't specifically ban them, didn't specifically outlaw them. The state Supreme Court has weighed in now and said, yeah, no more ballot boxes. Do you think it is worth revisiting some of those procedure things that sometimes in state law is left with a little gray area?
So, you know, here's a place where my good friend federalism comes in, right? Federalism is the relationship between the national and the state governments in the United States. And federalism is a principle that allows states an enormous amount of control over many things, in this example, elections. The federal government sets a few standards for how states have to behave around elections and then leaves most of those things to states to decide, and much to localities. So drop boxes became a huge deal here in Wisconsin because some people believed that in the context of a global pandemic, it didn't make sense to give people a safer way to vote. But the issue is drop boxes have been used here in Wisconsin for times before the pandemic. They're used around the country routinely, and they are largely successful. So one of the problems we have is, as you say, state law does not prohibit, but does not also explicitly empower the use of drop boxes. And so those judgments were left to election officials. State law would help elections officials if it was clear on matters. But what we as a people need to be able to feel confident about is that the decisions that are made about how elections should be carried out are done without political consideration, because a particular party holds the legislature now, and they could write election laws that benefit them. But then at some point down the road, things can change. And so I think the voters and the people of the state need to feel confident that the laws are being made in the best interest of the people, not one of the political parties.
We're talking to Kathleen Dolan, Distinguished Professor of Political Science at UW-Milwaukee. Kathy's joining us to talk about the end of the Republican-led investigation into Wisconsin's 2020 presidential elections. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on that investigation? Are you glad it's over? Were there things you were still hoping to hear about? Do you feel confident in general that our elections are pretty well run in Wisconsin? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with Kathleen Dolan, Distinguished Professor of Political Science at UW-Milwaukee, looking at the end of the Wisconsin Republican-led investigation into the 2020 presidential election. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Michael is with us in Appleton. Michael, hi.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for taking my call, and thanks for taking the time out of the show with the show to talk about this subject. I just wanted to, agree to echo the sentiments that the guest and the previous caller that I heard share. From the beginning, I think this whole investigation has been pretty much the definition of a farce. I mean, it was started based on no real substantial evidence of any kind, and was continued, in much the same way. And much like the previous caller said, it would be comical if it weren't such a waste of Wisconsin taxpayer money. So that's all. Thank you.
Michael, thanks for that call. Kathy, given this kind of sustained messaging about, claims of fraud in the election, do you see ways for to remind people how elections work to counter claim those claims?
Well, that is an important point because most people really don't have any idea how elections work. And generally, usually they don't really need to understand. Elections here in Wisconsin are, quite well administered and usually go very, very smoothly. So basic things. So during the 2020 election, one of the things that was frustrating to me, and I tend to know more about these things because of what I do for a living, but here in Wisconsin, our law states that absentee ballots cannot be counted before Election Day. Again, that's one of those things that's done differently in other states. And so if you think about the concerns that the former president raised about the returns in Wisconsin, because it took a long time for Milwaukee to count all of its votes and they tend to come in later. Clerks around the state had asked the legislature to change the law to allow them to start processing absentee ballots ahead of Election Day. If the legislature had given the clerks that go ahead, we wouldn't have had the concerns, and I'm making bunny ears when I say concerns, that people raised about the returns in Milwaukee particularly. The legislature simply refused to do that. So there are ways in which the people of the state don't know how and when and under what circumstances things are being processed. And perhaps if we were more transparent and let people know that here are the rules, here are how clerks work, here are the ways in which things are reported, it might help individuals understand that there isn't a problem and that there is, good evidence of that. But again, we can look to other states to how they administer their elections. And there's very, 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 very little election fraud anywhere in the United States. And there are places that do things very differently than Wisconsin does with much success. And so we could even look to other states for successful ways of administering things.
Thanks for the call. Richard joins us now in Cambridge. Richard, hi.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. First of all, what she said is absolutely right. The one thing the legislature could have fixed, they didn't. On the general topic of our election safe, I'm 71 years old, a lifelong resident of Wisconsin, and we've never had any problems with our elections ever. Everything that they brought up was just to make problems, raise doubts, based on no proof. The reason I called was this question. Can't we taxpayers get our money back from this bogus investigation? And who would do that? Does it need to be a citizen who takes this to court? Or is this something Josh Call could do? And that's it for me. Thank you very much.
Richard, thanks for the call. I know there's some questions at this point over how some of the lawsuits will be paid for related to open records, but I'm guessing, Kathy, there's probably not a mechanism to claw back the money spent for the most part.
You know, that is well beyond my area of expertise, and I wouldn't want to put out anything about that. I do know that people would like to see the money reimbursed, but I just don't know if a mechanism exists or if Speaker Voss has the power to encumber that money as he chooses.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Kathleen Dolan from UW-Milwaukee, political scientist there, looking at the end of the Gableman probe into Wisconsin's elections. What came out of that? What didn't come out of it? How it fits into wider efforts to call it a question, elections in the United States? You can join in at 800-642-1234. Kathy, I know a concern about this story here in Wisconsin and in so many other countries is, as our caller just said, you know, this is being an effort to create doubt about our elections, to allow election results to be overturned at some later stage, like was an attempt to happen on January 6th, trying to send things back to state legislatures. Do you worry that this is basically setting up a pretext for overturning election at some stage in the game?
Yes, I think those concerns are valid. I think that what happened after the 2020 election, culminating in January 6th and since January 6th, is part of a concerted playbook about laying a base for even as early as 2024. As I said a minute ago, that there are some Republicans around the country who are being elected as election deniers. And in four states, we have very rabid election deniers who have won Republican primaries to serve as Secretary of State. In most states, Secretaries of State are the people who administer elections. And so if this atmosphere over the last couple of years helps to put in place people who want to deny the way elections are run, then that puts power into the hands of the wrong people in 2024. We have heard people here in Wisconsin, we hear the Republican candidate for governor say, well, you know, I'm not sure what happened. We'll have to take a look. I don't feel comfortable in 2024 with knowing that there are people in power who might want to do things against the rules. So, yes, I do believe that we are headed for a bigger problem in 2024.
It's kind of a whack-a-mole game in a lot of ways with all the different theories, claims of fraud out there. We've had a couple of callers reference the Dinesh D'Souza film, 2000 Mules, claiming to have evidence about ballot box fraud. We saw former Attorney General Bill Barr debunk that in the January 6th hearings. What do you think about this, just the variety of theories out there and how hard it is to catch up with all of them?
Well, that is unfortunately a larger problem of the human psyche, right? I mean, we know at its most basic that it's a lot easier for people to keep the information they hear first than it is for them to hear the refutation. And so as former President Trump played, you know, very well over his time, you say words and people hear those words and believe them. People are much less likely to take evidence against their own beliefs, right? People's beliefs support what they believe to be true, and they take information that supports those beliefs, and they tend to reject information that would stand in opposition to those beliefs. So convincing people who hold election-denying theories that they are wrong is extraordinarily difficult. And as you say, it is particularly difficult because there are so many things that people have decided went wrong, and there are so many threads and strands. And that's part of my pessimism about 2024, because it is literally impossible to get people to change their worldviews when they're so dug in on those conspiracy theories.
Are there institutional changes you see that we need to help make sure that we don't have an effort to overturn an election result actually succeed?
Well, the bill that's working its way through Congress right now to change some of the unclear pieces of the Electoral Count Act. You know, you say you use the example of the Wisconsin law having a lack of clarity here around ballot boxes. You know, part of the challenge in 2020 was that the system, the Electoral Count Act, and the system of counting Electoral College votes was not as crystal clear and did not limit problems in a way that it could have. And so if the Senate is able to strengthen that law and to make the procedures clearer, that could go a good way to helping to protect the system in 2024.
In just our last minute, Kathy, what are you watching for next on these election-related integrity issues?
I'm interested in continuing to look. So after 2020, one of the things that happened is that many states changed their laws to tighten up the opportunities for people to vote. In 17 states that the Republicans hold the legislature, they constricted the right to vote by making it more difficult for people to do so. And they did it based on these supposed arguments about election fraud. I'm, you know, watching in 2022 how some of those new laws will affect the opportunities for people to vote, you know, whether it's decreasing the number of polling places in certain areas or making laws about times. You know, we saw Georgia pass a law that makes it illegal to give water to somebody waiting in line at a polling place. So there's been a real micromanagement in many states in the last 2 years to really tighten up laws. And if there is no evidence, these laws are being tightened for the wrong reasons, most of which are political. So I'm interested in seeing how these new laws take effect and play out in the 2022 midterms.
Kathy, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Sure. Thank you.
That was Kathy Dolan, Distinguished Professor of Political Science at the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee. She joined us to talk about Michael Gabelman's investigation into election fraud, which has come to an end now after Robin Voss fired him last Friday. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, a look at Lord of the Rings archives at Marquette University. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Now, picture the scene, a small group of eccentric creative types work in a decrepit building and come up with an innovative product that sweeps the world, earning millions of dollars. The company sees ups and downs, takeovers, and drama, but that product ushers in a new era. Is it Silicon Valley? Seattle? No, it's Lake Geneva, Wisconsin in the 1970s. The product? A new kind of game called Dungeons & Dragons. Here's a game of D&D in action in the Netflix hit series Stranger Things.
The hooded cultists chant, "Hail, Lord Vecna. Hail, Lord Vecna." They turn to you, remove their hoods. You recognize most of them from Mokbar. There is one you do not recognize. His skin shriveled, desiccated. Something else. He is not only missing his left arm, but his left eye.
Vecna's dead.
He killed my cat.
So it was thought, my friend. So it was thought. But Vecna lives.
Vecna lives, and so does Dungeons & Dragons. In his new book, our next guest tells the story of the rise and fall of TSR, the Lake Geneva company that made Dungeons & Dragons, and the buyout that kept the game alive. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you now, or have you ever been a D&D player? Were your kids, your grandkids, were you there at Ground Zero? Maybe even in Lake Geneva yourself? Did you play in the early days? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Ben Riggs is a writer, teacher, and podcaster from Milwaukee, where he teaches English and history. He's the host of a role-playing game podcast called Plot Points, and his new book is called Slaying the Dragon, A Secret History of Dungeons & Dragons. Ben, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here. It's a dream to be on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Fantastic. Well, glad to have you. Now, you tell the story not just of the creative side of the creation of Dungeons and Dragons, but also the business side. And this was, TSR was in the business papers you write. What made you want to dig into that side of the story?
So it was a story that demanded to be told. About 6 years ago, I was writing for Geek and Sundry, and I was assigned an article tentatively titled, "Did You Know That Dungeons and Dragons Wasn't Always Made in Seattle?" And being in Wisconsin and knowing a bunch of the old hands back here, I was given the job of writing that article. And as I worked on it, one article became three articles, and people started sending me documents in the mail asking to be confidential. I got interviews with people no one had talked to before. So the writing stretched out over 6 years, and I was like, if I don't write this, no one will. And it's a piece of Wisconsin history that has not yet seen the light of day. So it's been a pleasure to write, and I'm really glad that people are reacting so positively to the book.
Take us back to the origin here. We've got this really in Lake Geneva, this local eccentric, as you describe him, Gary Gygax, go from, you know, an out of work cobbler at some points to the creator of this new kind of game.
Yeah, I mean, you could argue that Gary Gygax is the most influential Wisconsinite in our state's history. And yet nobody really talks about him much. Lake Geneva doesn't even have a statue to him. He was an unemployed insurance underwriter fixing shoes in his children's basement, who was designing wargaming rules for fun. And one of his kids told me, you know, he only made enough money from that to like take the family out to dinner once or twice. Then a guy comes down from Minnesota, Dave Arneson, and he shows Gary Gygax what he did with one of his wargames, a wargame called Chainmail. And Dave Arneson took that game and he used it to, he gave players a single character, which was new. They were exploring a dungeon, and these characters persisted from game session to game session and increased in power as they went along. And Gary Gygax was like, holy cow, this is amazing. Dave Arneson, give me all the rules to this game. So Dave Arneson sent him between 18 and 24 cribbed and cramped pages. Gary Gygax took that and set about making it into a rule set that would be called Dungeons and Dragons. But again, what he created was so radical, so new, we're still grappling with it today. It's like someone invented acting in 1974. Gary Gygax and Dave Arneson found something new to do with pencils, papers, and your brain that no one thought of before. So again, it's one of the reasons that people oftentimes grapple with explaining how to play D&D and what D&D is. But Wisconsin saw the birth of a totally new medium, one in which the player is like the actor and audience at the same time. Again, Lake Geneva, Wisconsin really is a mecca. And again, I feel like we don't appreciate it properly within the state. Did that answer your question?
Oh, yeah. And now this company, TSR, Tactical Studies Rules, it stands for, they end up having this multi-million dollar product. Can you talk about how it went from that germ of an idea to this thing that really just swept the country, including to a young fellow named Rob, just coming out of elementary school, if I could age myself?
So yeah, the growth of the game was exponential. Tactical Studies Rules, TSR, was founded because no other company would publish the rules. They just didn't see what the market for it was going to be. But the ability to take one character and control them and do anything was addictive. I want to say the first 1,000 copies sold out in a little under a year. The second 1,000 copies sold out in like 5 or 6 months. And it really saw exponential growth through 1983, as I recall. Again, it was slowed by the fact that it is really hard to explain how to play, but it's very easy to watch someone play and be like, oh, that's what you do in a role-playing mm-hmm. game. It's why role-playing games have really taken off now in the 21st century, because YouTube allows you to watch people play all day long, and that's the best way to learn how to play. But the fact that D&D was so new and such an innovation, that really drove that first burst of growth through the early 80s. And then there was a crisis, and Gary Gygax lost control of D&D and the company, and the game was purchased by a woman named Lorraine Williams, who oversaw the company's Silver Age through 1997, when it was finally purchased by Magic the Gathering creators Wizards of the Coast, and took the game out to Seattle, and Wisconsin lost a jewel, sadly, although the Wizards of the Coast, I think, has done a very good job with it. Did that make sense?
Yeah, we're talking to Milwaukee-based writer, teacher, and podcaster Ben Riggs about a big piece of Wisconsin history. His new book is called Slaying the Dragon, A Secret History of Dungeons and Dragons, looking at the invention of a whole genre of games called role-playing game that ended up being influential in lots of other stuff, including computer games. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about the history of the game, what it is, how it works? Are you part of that history? Do you play it now? Did you maybe years ago? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Ben, as you mentioned, there was kind of there have been multiple crisis periods in the history of the game and of TSR. It seems like one problem was they'd come up with this product. They made lots of money at it. None of them really knew a lot about how to run a business, though, in a lot of ways.
Yeah, at TSR, initially you had, again, Gary Gygax was an insurance underwriter and cobbler. You had a pharmacist, you had a pipe fitter, and they were running the company. And, you know, life is well and good when your product is growing exponentially. And then when Lorraine Williams took over, again, she'd worked in business, but her degree was not in business. And she did hire business people, but she tended to hire, you know, like people from the cardboard industry are suddenly working at TSR dealing with artists and writers. You had one executive come down to Brahm, a genius artist who would create these gloomy landscapes and these intriguing, mysterious characters, you know, but tended to be fairly monochrome. And this executive says to Brahm, now make sure you use all your colors in this painting because it's important, and which is a bit like telling Shakespeare to use more words. So there definitely was a gap between the business ability of the people running the company and perhaps what it should have been. Role-playing games are also a difficult business. You know, mm-hmm. If you drink a bottle of Miller, if you want more Miller, you have to go buy more. If you spent $30 on Dungeons & Dragons rule books in 1979, you could still be playing with them today and never would have needed anything else. The fact that, you know, this is an evergreen product that never goes bad causes real problems for role-playing game companies, because after you sell it to them once, what do you do? And Dungeons & Dragons has tried to come up with new editions and use that as an engine of growth for the game. And the current edition, 5th edition, is apparently a huge hit. I don't have sales numbers for it, but the Player's Handbook came out 8 years ago, and it's still in, like, the top 50 sellers on Amazon today. That's crazy. Wizards of the Coast claims that they've had 50 million people experience the game, even if that means 25 million people have played it. That's tremendous growth. Like, I would say that when the game was in Wisconsin, it probably maxed out around 2 million players. So it's grown exponentially since it left the state.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Kathleen is with us in Elgin. Kathleen, hi.
Hi. You're talking about Dungeons and Dragons, and I remember around Halloween of 1985, I worked at a club in Chicago called Limelight, and at the Halloween party, I met a guy, and it was a costume party, dressed like a vampire, asked me to go out for dinner, and I said yes, and on the way home, I realized I have no idea what this guy looks like when he shows up at the door. Well, it turns out he worked for TSR. He knew that I had a young son. And he brought with him, I guess, to curry points with me, every single thing that TSR had put out up until that point. And, I mean, the stuff just kept coming up to the door, box after box after box of stuff. And my son was, like, the hit of the neighborhood for, I don't even remember how every kid in the world ended up at my house, which I'd rather have than him going wherever they would go. And, yes, now he's 50 years old, and he has actually moved out of my basement. He doesn't still live down in the basement playing D&D.
Kathleen, thanks a lot for sharing that story. It's a great story. I don't exactly remember D&D in the 80s being the ticket to popularity, Ben, but it has changed in some ways from being this really niche nerd thing to a lot more people play it than that original core audience.
You know, I hope this might sound silly, I teach seventh and eighth grade, and it was about a year ago I wandered into the teacher's lounge, and it was filled with women under 30 talking about their D&D campaigns. And again, for me as a white guy in my 40s, where role-playing games were pretty white and pretty male, it blew my mind. I would honestly tell you, as popular as role-playing games have become, indications are that it's even the rate of increase in players is about to go vertical. The speed of increase seems to be picking up, not slowing down, which again is crazy to think about. You know, when you think about how nerdy and niche role-playing games were in the 80s and 90s, you feel glad that they're even talking about them on TV shows. But the fact that, again, I honestly believe that we're about to see a multiple of the number of people currently playing start playing, that is my prediction. Did that make sense?
Sure. Thanks for that call. We're talking to Milwaukee-based writer, teacher, and podcaster Ben Riggs about his new book. It's called Slaying the Dragon, A Secret History of Dungeons and Dragons. It tells the story of TSR, the Lake Geneva company behind the famous role-playing game. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about the history of Dungeons and Dragons or what the heck it is? Have you played it over the last year, over the last five decades? Do you have a memory you want to share? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Ben Riggs. He's from Milwaukee. His new book is called Slaying the Dragon, A Secret History of Dungeons and Dragons. You can join in with your memories, your questions at 800-642-1234. Memories from five decades ago or from a session last night. Rick joins us now in Evansville. Rick, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. First off, I want to let you know that, yes, I did buy the book and I have started reading it. I've only gotten through the first chapter, but so far it's great.
Thanks, Rick.
Secondly, I used to play back in the day, late 70s, early 80s, junior high, high school. And it was fun then, but it was a little harder to play because you had to make everything up yourself. You're playing there in your head with the rule book, a notebook, and graph paper. Nowadays, I've started playing again due to my daughter getting into it, and now my granddaughter is really getting into it. So we've started playing it again with the fifth edition stuff, and they've made it so much easier with all of the pre-written campaigns to go on. There's pre-written, pre-planned single-shot games where you come in with a brand-new character, play for 2 hours, do one adventure and then you're done, or you can continue those characters on to other adventures.
Rick, thanks a lot for sharing the love that you're playing multi-generational D&D there. Ben, what do you think?
I think that intergenerational experience is becoming happily common. Again, like it's something that, my parents never really understood, but now it does seem to be a thing that you and your kids can do together. I have an 18-month-old, and one of my friends was like, oh, only 10 years until you have a new player in your D&D campaign. And I'm like, oh, yeah, that's true. Also, again, there has been a huge proliferation of materials for Dungeons & Dragons. Wizards of the Coast did something radical with the D&D intellectual property about 22 years ago, and they opened it up. Essentially, anyone who wants to can make their own D&D rule books, can make their own D&D settings, put them up for sale on the internet, and make money off them and not have to send Wizards of the Coast a dime. And the result of that really has been an incredible richness of settings and adventures and options for Dungeons & Dragons players. It may be, again, one of the reasons that you're seeing this exponential growth in players is that the IP is open. It'd be like Disney saying anybody can make a Star Wars movie. It's crazy.
Thanks a lot for that call. We heard from Dan in West Salem who emailed about, it wasn't just TSR, but it was also the gaming convention Gen Con that got really huge in Lake Geneva until it was finally moved, I think, to Indianapolis at some point. That was a big part of the story of Wisconsin's role in gaming, though, Ben.
Oh, it's amazing. Gary Gygax also started Gen Con. You know, like, again, if you're looking for a reason to call Gary Gygax the most influential Wisconsinian of all time, he didn't only create a radical new medium. He created the largest tabletop and role-playing game convention in North America. It moved out of Lake Geneva to UW campuses. I forget which ones. Then it settled in Milwaukee for a good long time. And then when Wizards of the Coast bought Dungeons and Dragons, they ended up moving it to Indianapolis. And Indianapolis does do a really good job with it. Again, I feel like, you know, I'm a Milwaukeean. I went to Gen Con in Milwaukee. Indianapolis does a better job with the convention than we did. Again, it feels like Dungeons and Dragons, TSR, all of that has always been something that the state is more ashamed of than proud of. And I think it's one of the reasons we lost that convention.
Let's go back to our callers now. Valerie is with us in Milwaukee. Valerie, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What do you want to tell us about?
Sure. So I'm 30, and I've wanted to play D&D for a long time, but I was always kind of intimidated by it. And I have been watching a lot more web programs like Dimension 20 and Critical Role, where you can watch people playing these really long, wonderfully creative campaigns. And I think it's great to make it more accessible. I just started playing my own campaign a few months ago, and I just want to kind of bring up that new exciting aspect of it.
Valerie, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. Ben, yeah, there are a lot of things where you can watch other people playing D&D and other role-playing games.
Yeah, about huzzah for you, Valerie. About 14 years ago, I thought tabletop role-playing games were dead. I went and bought everything I wanted. I put it in my basement, and I thought, role-playing games are done. They've been killed by video games and the recession, and it's over now. People will look at it the way they look at Pet Rocks. But I could not have been more wrong. Both video games and the internet have been fantastic for tabletop role-playing games. Video games essentially teach you how to play role-playing games because they stole so much from Dungeons and Dragons, hit points, levels. And YouTube, which again, I thought people would be on there watching pirated South Park or something. Instead, YouTube is a gigantic engine for teaching people how to play Dungeons and Dragons with the best imaginable teachers, with voice actors and comedians playing the game, making it look just amazing. Not only that, but tabletop role-playing game has something that electronics do not have, which is just you have to gather with other human beings and experience the animal warmth of your fellows, which again, when we're online all day with Zoom, when we are just engaging more and more electronically, being able to get together with people and to have to get together with them to play this game, it's just a tonic and antidote to all of that.
Thanks for that call. And just our last minute, there is an effort to establish that statue that isn't there in Lake Geneva, I think, for Gary Gygax. What are you hoping for to get Wisconsin to recognize this part of its history?
Wow, that's a good question. I would say we could start with Governor Evers officially recognizing Gary Gygax Day, which just recently passed. Because, hey, again, if he's the most influential Wisconsinian of all time, we should at least take one day of the year and make it an official holiday here in Wisconsin. So that is what I will push for, sir, making Gary Gygax Day an official holiday in the state of Wisconsin.
All right, roll 20, difficulty 15 to make that happen, Ben. Ben, thanks a lot for joining us today. It's been a lot of fun.
My pleasure. I'll be anytime you want me on. Oh, and if you're really interested in D&D, you can see D&D sales numbers on my Twitter page. It's at @BenRiggs_.
Ben Riggs is a writer, teacher, and podcaster from Milwaukee. We've been talking about his new book. It's called Slaying the Dragon, A Secret History of Dungeons and Dragons, looking at the origins of this incredibly influential new kind of game. Got its start in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin. He tracks the twists and turns both on the creative side and the business side of things. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, you may have heard this piece of career advice. Follow your passion. We'll hear some pushback to that idea, saying that it doesn't really lead to happiness or to success. And a lot of people, speaking of jobs, have switched jobs over the course of the pandemic. A lot of them got pay increases when they did it. But our guest says that time may be coming to an end. Find out what's going on in the aftermath of the Great Resignation. that and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time on the Ideas Network.